Good afternoon. Please be seated. This is case number 72988, Kenneth Franks versus State. Ms. Rasmussen for the appellant, Ms. Clemens for the respondent. And both of you are making history because this will be the last time that I appear in oral argument for the Supreme Court of Nevada. Ms. Rasmussen, you want to save some time on the rebuttal?
Yes, 5 minutes, please.
Okay, I'll watch the clock for you.
Thank you, and congratulations on your last bit of oral argument. So, may it please the court and opposing counsel Lisa Rasmussen on behalf of Kenneth Franks, also with me at counsel table is my associate Jim Hoffman. I think that the primary issue in this is the admission of other bad acts without, in the absence of a Petrocelli hearing or any determination making any findings by the trial court. And then those other bad acts were, which were just, by the way, some fleeting reference to, oh yeah, he did this five other times. And not only were they admitted in the absence of a Petrocelli hearing, that error was compounded by the fact that the jurors were given a jury instruction stating specifically that they could consider those bad acts for evidence of propensity, which is completely contrary to Nevada law and the statute.
Well, at the time.
At the time. The statute, well, and I'll talk about the statute. The statute, and the respondents bring that up in their brief, but 48.045 in operation at that time did actually not have subsection 3, which says nothing in this section shall be construed to prohibit the admission of evidence in a criminal prosecution for sexual offense that a person committed another crime, wrong, or act that constitutes a separate sexual offense. That was enacted by the legislature in the 2015 session, went into effect on October 1, 2015, but did not apply retroactively to any cases that were previously filed. So this case was filed on September 15th, 2015. So that actually doesn't apply, although respondents believe that it somehow does. But even if it did apply, it would not impact the court's requirement to hold a Petrocelli hearing and to make the findings that the court is required to make under Petrocelli. There's nothing about that statutory provision that obviates any weighing requirement on the part of the trial court. I didn't try this case, and certainly there are some IAC issues that are for another day, but the fact that trial counsel didn't object to the admission of those doesn't mean that this court can just say, well, trial counsel didn't object. So the court has to review it and has to review it for plain error, as with the jury instruction. And I think it's really clear that the jury instruction is wrong. It's just completely wrong to say it can be considered for propensity. And I don't believe that the state adequately responds to that argument at all. But I think what this court has to look at is, first you've got the lack of Petrocelli process. Then you've got Big Pond, which clearly states that bad acts are not permitted to show character or propensity in any form. And that if there's clear and convincing evidence, which there absolutely is not in this case, because if there were clear and convincing evidence, they would have been added to the criminal charge.
How did it happen that there wasn't a Petrocelli hearing?
Trial counsel, I think, for his own inexperience in criminal cases, frankly, is my suggestion, didn't ask for a Petrocelli hearing, but the state also didn't file anything. You know, normally in criminal cases, the state files something requesting permission to admit other bad acts, and then we have a hearing. In this case, that didn't happen. So it's a combination of trial counsel not picking up on it and the state not filing a motion, asking permission to introduce other bad acts at trial.
Did the judge say anything about that when the issue of bad acts came up? Hey, we haven't had a Pretzschella hearing or?
No. The court also then needs to look at whether or not it's reversible, and the Nevada Supreme Court has spoken in a couple different instances on that. One of the cases is Rimes v. State, where this court said no, it wasn't reversible error, but in Meek v. State, the court said yes. And in Meek v. State, what's interesting in that case is that this court said it's insufficient to establish probable cause. If it's insufficient evidence to establish probable cause, like could these other acts have been added? Because she just sort of says that it's the same person. And this is different than a case where there might be another act that this defendant committed, but it's a different victim. This is all the same person. So the state didn't charge him with those other five acts. They only charged him with one, which is the only one where the state felt that she could give any reliable information. So that's telling. But, you know, going back to Meek v. State, there the court said if there's not sufficient evidence to establish probable cause, in other words, in the filing of a complaint and having a preliminary hearing, there's certainly not clear and convincing evidence. And all of that is contrary to Big Pond. And there even in Meek v. State, this court also comments that even with a limiting instruction, it's doubtful that such admission of such evidence would be harmless. The jury instructions specifically advised the jurors that they could consider those acts for intent, motive, or propensity. And then the jurors were specifically told in closing, you're allowed to look at motive, intent, and propensity, but you're not allowed to generally consider him a bad guy. And I discussed in the brief that really that's what propensity often is evidence of character. It's certainly how it was offered in this case.
Is there anything in the record about that the bad act was shown to by clear and convincing evidence, or that there was probative value outweighs the prejudice?
There's nothing in the record discussing the probative value outweighing the prejudice. There's no Petrocelli dialogue. And there's nothing in the record really addressing it with any sufficiency. I mean, the court doesn't address it. The court allows the jury instruction to go forward.
Do you want to comment on clear and convincing and probative value? Even though it'd be plain error, do you want to comment on that at all?
I absolutely do, and I think that's what I was trying to say with regard. It's clearly not clear and convincing because the state didn't charge it because there was never any specific information to identify these other alleged five times. Because this was the same alleged victim or complaining witness, if the state had sufficient evidence to bring five counts, they would have brought five counts. They didn't. They brought one count because they only had detail on one. So that's what Meek says, is if you can't meet a probable cause standard, you certainly can't meet a clear and convincing evidence standard.
Did the judge instruct the jury prior to the time that the evidence came in of the bad act under Travers or whatever that case is?
I don't believe that she did, but I could be wrong on that, so I don't... I don't believe that she did. I don't believe that. I think that the jury was instructed, or opposing counsel at a minimum said in closing, you can't consider it as evidence that he's a bad guy, but you can consider it as evidence of motive, intent, or propensity.
So there was a jury instruction to that?
Yes, the jury instructions specifically instructed that they could use that evidence as evidence of intent, motive, or propensity.
Don't you think Meeks is distinguishable a bit from our case? I mean, do you think, I mean, in Meeks you had a grand jury's refusal to indict. We don't certainly have that mm-hmm. here. Do you think Meeks is really your vehicle for that point?
I don't know that it's the vehicle. I think that it's a case that discusses similar context. where it talks about lack of probable cause. Yes, Meeks is different because the grand jury specifically refused to indict. In this case, didn't go through the indictment procedure. It went through a probable cause or preliminary hearing, which he, in fact, waived. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that it's really different because I think that the court can safely assume that the state had evidence of that he had committed this act or a similar act on four other occasions, that they would have included it.
Wouldn't that apply to like almost, to a number of bad acts? I mean, does the state have to charge every bad act that it has clear and convincing evidence?
And in fairness, I don't think they do, but mm-hmm. I also think that the court's required to make a determination that there's clear and convincing evidence, and it's also required to do the probative prejudicial analysis, which I didn't really get to, but I can do it in my rebuttal if the court pleases.
You have 4 minutes and 46 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Clemens for the state.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Clemens. I'm a Chief Deputy District Attorney at the Clark County DA's Office in the Special Victims Unit. If you don't have any direct questions right away, I'll start with the argument. So as counsel noted, trial counsel did fail to object to any of these issues, so we're obviously here on a plain error standard.
Is counsel asleep at the, what happened?
Well, no, he did make objections during the trial. I read all the trial transcripts. I think the victim in this case was very soft-spoken, she was very shy, and she was very nervous. And so as you probably read through the transcript, I had to present her with her testimony to their interview with the detective quite a few times. And I think that became kind of a long process, and so we were all trying to figure out what is she testifying to in terms of the charge. And then when the bad acts come out, it's more because this became a timeline defense, which obviously the state's unaware of what the defense is going to be at the beginning of trial. When it's a timeline defense, the state's position is saying things like this is not the first time this happened or the last time it happened, it's happened more than once, is relevant because it helps explain why the victim is unable to say with more specificity what happened in the charged event. So we charged the timeline of June because all the witnesses seem to basically confirm and corroborate that they were over there in June. The dad testified that the victim left crying the last time they went over before they left for New Jersey, which was the end of June. The defendant himself stated he felt that they were over there the beginning of June. The victim said the end of the school year, she wasn't totally sure. So that's where we came up with the June. But when defense's argument is basically, this happened, it didn't happen in June, it opens the door in the state's position to saying, well, this happened to me basically almost every time I went over there. So yeah, I can't remember, what I was doing right beforehand, what I did afterwards, but I do remember the actual last incident. So that's kind of how this came about.
Did the defense have notice of the bad acts?
In reviewing the case, my trial counsel and I were trying to figure out kind of how this happened. The transcript of the victim's statement, she does make reference to this incident at the computer. It's not as in much detail as she testified to at trial. So, the state has to plead things with particularity under Rose and I think it's LaPanier. So we can't just say, well, she says five times, so let's just charge five counts. We need to have kind of specifics as to make sure that this happened, where she was. She remembered, getting pulled out the door. The computer incident, we didn't feel was specific enough to charge it as a criminal charge. That doesn't mean that it's not admissible under a clear and convincing evidence standard. As Quayles and McNulton, which happened, they were decided after Meeks, they said, the victim's testimony alone on these bad acts is enough. And as Justice pointed out, we didn't go to the grand jury and it's not like they didn't indict on this. We didn't try to get it through preliminary hearing and the judge said no. This is the same conduct, less inflammatory, because it was touching over the clothes and not under the clothes, which is what the main event that we were talking about is. So that's kind of the state's theory behind why we charged what we did and why we chose not to charge this incident.
Ms. Clemens, help me out. Pretend that you're me.
Yes.
And that you got to convince, you're writing the order or the opinion in this matter to show that propensity is applicable
in
this situation depending on the statute. Help me.
Okay.
How would you write it?
So
be Justice Cherry.
Yes, the legislature amended the statute to add subsection 3, which basically allows for propensity evidence. The legislature was given a lot of extensive legislative history from California, which that statute's virtually the same as ours. The way they write it, the tenses are different, but it's worded virtually the same. They were advised on how California courts have handled the issue with propensity. They were also advised by the defense bar that this court had decided in Braustein that propensity is not appropriate. So the legislature in there decided that, you know what, we're going to have propensity in sex cases because sex cases are different than any other type of case. It's often in secret. You often have minor children who can't remember a lot of details. So this is the one exception where we're going to allow this. The reason why it's applicable in this case is because when you look at the bottom of the statute, it applied to, quote, a court proceeding that is commenced on or after October 1st, 2015. While the criminal complaint was filed in September, there were multiple court proceedings after October 1st. The arraignment, the information was filed in district court after October 1st. We went to trial way after October 1st. It's also not an ex post facto law. It's not a change that increased the punishment of the crime or changed the definition of the crime. This is an evidentiary decision. It's not something that all of a sudden now he's looking at 25 to life instead of 10 to life. I think what's on point here is there's a case, Hollander v. Warden, Nevada State Prison. It's 86 Nevada 369. This court addressed whether or not an individual who's adjudicated as a habitual felon, what happened was is that his prior conviction from California was a felony in California, but it was considered a misdemeanor in Nevada. It was moved up to a felony in Nevada. When he went to trial, the state used that new felony, as a means to habitualize him, and this court agreed that because the charge that he was on trial for, it didn't change the punishment for that charge, it was appropriate, even though it did change the adjudication of him being a habitual felon, it ultimately did punish him more.
But doesn't the statute by its terms say for actions or proceedings that are commenced on or after October 1st, 2015, don't you agree that a criminal complaint commences a criminal action?
Yeah, I would say a criminal complaint filing of a criminal complaint is a court proceeding, but so is filing of information.
This is commenced to a court proceeding that is commenced on or after. So commenced, I take to mean starts.
Well, I would disagree. I think commenced could be any proceeding. So if they wanted it to be a criminal complaint filed after October 1st, I think they would have been more specific about that. I think the intent was that the evidentiary ruling would start after the amendment was filed.
Is there anything in legislative history that would help us so that if I would write, so long as there is a proceeding, which a jury trial is a proceeding, propensity is applicable under the statute. Is there something in legislative history where somebody testified or some legislator said, hey, wait a minute, what if the event occurred before the statute, but the case was going on after the statute?
No, Your Honor, I'm not familiar in terms of what exactly was discussed in terms of timeline, but I can tell you in California they addressed this right when their statute came out in the Fitch case, which is cited in our brief. The Fitch, or their amendment, so in that case, the defendant's action began August 1995. The evidence code was enacted in 1995 but did not come effective until 1996. So it's very similar to here where you have the criminal action starting. There's a change in the law, and then by the time he goes to trial, they apply the propensity. And because the California court said this isn't an ex post facto law, that it was valid for the state to use the propensity and the court to allow the propensity to come in.
I'm going to have to check with Ms. Brown, our clerk, but I think this issue is pending someplace. I remember reading it just recently as to this issue, this exact issue. I don't know if it was in Bach, Northern Panel, or Southern Panel, but I think it's a recent bench memo that I saw, unless I'm mistaken. I don't know, maybe Elizabeth can help me out down the line. So I don't know, but this panel can make this decision.
So Ms. Clemens, I think I understand what the issue
sure.
is. If it's found to be that you know, commenced is means starting it.
Sure.
You know, just for purposes of argument, then you'd agree that the instruction about propensity was error.
If this court were to decide that wasn't appropriate, then the inclusion of propensity would automatically follow that it's error. But it would be, it's plain error. And the thing is that neither parties really drew attention to that in closing. I read the bad act statute and defined propensity, but I never applied it to the facts. So it was such a fleeting, it wasn't the focus. The focus was timeline. The focus was corroboration of witnesses. So even if that was error, it wouldn't be a reversible error. It would just be plain error because of all of the evidence in the case. All of the state's witnesses, even frankly the defense witnesses in a way, corroborated where this could have happened, the timing that happened, why the victim disclosed, her behavior disclosing. The defense witnesses were, I mean, frankly, the jury assessed them, but, I mean, I don't think they found them believable the way the verdict came down.
Would you address it in the context then as a bad act outside of the 045?
Yes. And we would say that, you know, your decisions, this court's decisions have said that failure to have the Petrocelli hearing isn't going to be reversible error. What's interesting in the defendant's or the appellant's reply brief, they concede that this would have come in under motive and intent. And they say, well, but there should have been hearing, so it should be reversed. It was proven by clear and convincing evidence by the victim's testimony. She was able to give the example that she was at the defendant's computer. When he came over, he touched her with his hand over her clothes and her private part, and that this would happen when they were on the visits to grandmother's house. That, in and of itself, is enough to provide clear and convincing evidence. But you also have corroborative testimony of the father, who stated they would go to the game room when they would come over. Michael testified during his testimony that the kids would go in the game room, and in fact, he had seen the victim at Kenny's computer. So there was clear and convincing evidence. It wasn't more prejudicial because it's less inflammatory. It's touching over the clothes versus the under the clothes. And the result would have been the same.
And was the defense that the touching was accidental?
So it was a little hard to tell. I think it was a timeline, and then there were some hints that it was accidental, but defense didn't address that at all in his closing, so it's hard to know what the defense was. There was testimony from the detective that the defendant said it was accidental, mm-hmm. and that's where the intent would come in.
And that testimony was introduced at trial?
Yes.
Anything further?
Okay. Thank you.
4 minutes.
Mr. Rasmussen, rebuttal. 443.
Okay.
How would you write it on the propensity statute? We've had Ms. Clemens write for Justice Sherry. Now you become me and write it the other way.
So
with analytics.
Clear in the legislative history is no discussion about this potential bifurcation of court proceedings that commenced in September, yet were ongoing through December or you know the following year. That is non-existent in the legislative history, and I recall all of the legislative history on this because I was very involved with NACJ. So the statute is clear that it applies to court cases commencing on or after October 1, 2015.
Well, it says court proceedings. So is that a distinction? That's what Ms. Clemens is suggesting, that that's a distinction. They can
She's
say a court case
that a
commences or a court.
Which could be a trial, which could be a sentencing hearing. I disagree with that. I think that we go with the plain language of the statute. It's clear that there has to be a start date. There has to be a date when people are on notice. Otherwise, I mean, this would have been a topic of conversation at the legislature because we would have said, we, NACJ, would have said, that's great, everybody's going to rush to have their trial done before October 1st. So it's kind of a ridiculous proposition to suggest that you have to have completed your court proceedings by October 1st, otherwise you're going to be in a world of poop if you're, you know, happen to be charged with a sex offense crime that this is applicable to.
Well, ideally, if we had had a pretrial Petrocelli hearing, this issue could have been at least vetted by the court and by the DA and by the defense attorney.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't
better,
unfortunately. So it puts us in a spot of we either go with Ms. Clemens or we go with you on whether proceeding means, what does proceeding mean? It sounds like a Bill Clinton thing. What is a proceeding? Depends
right,
what proceeding
leave
is.
It at that.
Well, and all this is complicated by the fact that the, and this is a thin case to begin with. You know, and so when you're weighing whether this is reversible error or not, you have to consider that this is the thinnest of cases to begin with. I didn't, and I probably should have in the appendix, include the actual tape recording of my client's statement, which was not played for the jury. And you know, I commented on that in sentencing. It's in the record because I admitted it in the record at sentencing and said, you know, he never confesses to the crime. he's asked after 50 minutes of interrogation, is it possible that somehow your hand touched her genital when you were tickling her? And he says, anything is possible. That's his statement, which is actually sort of contrary to, I wouldn't say it's contrary to the actual words that the detective testified to, but it's contrary to the impression he left with the jury. And so what you have to begin with when you're weighing whether it's reversible error or not is it harmful? Is these, it, I mean, the even if the statute is somehow applicable, you still have to do the weighing of probative versus prejudicial. And there was no limiting instruction given to say, hey, you can't consider this for this purpose. And instead, the jurors were instructed to the contrary, that they absolutely could consider it. So you when you couple that with the fact that this is a very thin evidentiary case, I mean, the reason the state didn't charge those other instances is exactly what she told you. They couldn't determine with any specificity what exactly happened. The trial itself was full of testimony about people tickling each other in the armpits and the belly and people laughing hysterically, and that this went on more than one occasion. So I don't know that it came out clearly.
How did it come about that it was reported? That the molestation was reported. How did that happen?
So sometime after, and I believe it's months after, I think it's probably in August, this is allegedly in June, the victim tells a friend of hers who then tells her mother, and then the mother tells her parents. And then then they go and they meet with him, they have this 50-minute conversation with him, and then at the end when he says, oh, I suppose anything is possible, they arrest him. And so, and opposing counsel is right, a lot of the trial was about trying to determine who was where on what day, but also about the motive of the victim's father who dislikes the mother and kind of all of that cross purpose.
Any further questions, Justice Perriguer?
Thank you,
Ms. Rasmussen.
Thank you.
And Ms. Clemens, thank you both for your argument. You certainly have presented a challenge to this panel, both of you. Excellent arguments, good briefs. We'll see what happens. Thank you all.
Always an honor. Thank you.
Now, I was going to play my way for Frank Sinatra, but I figure that's a little much. But I do want to thank the voters of Clark County who put me on the district court bench for 8 years, and the voters of this state, except for those none of the above that were the voters of this state who put me on the Supreme Court for 12 years, and it's been a pleasure. And you know, I couldn't think of a better case or better litigators than the two of you to be my final case on oral argument. So congratulations to both of you. Both are excellent, excellent lawyers. You got great futures, both of you. There's no doubt in my mind. This matter is submitted and we'll recess until the call of the court without me.